and welcome to Cricket in England through five matches. In this series of podcasts, we've been examining aspects of English culture, society, and history in the early 20th century, and in each episode, doing so by looking at a single cricket match. In this episode, we visit Edgbaston in the summer of 1924 for a look at cricket and England's recovery from war, and a test match, England versus South Africa. The signing of the armistice on the 11th of November 1918 signalled not just the end of the war and the human toll which accompanied it, but also the start of fresh challenges for the nations on both sides of the conflict as to how to adjust to the new, peaceful, yet inevitably changed world. Along with all other pre-war institutions, the questions posed to English cricket as to how to re-emerge from its self-imposed slumber would mirror and be challenged by the post-war era into which it now emerged. It is tempting to try and provide a concise line of narrative for the period between the two great wars of the 20th century, to construct an unbroken picture of recovery, or of slump, or of class turmoil. The reality, as with most of history, is more fragmented, confusing, and contradictory. The 1914-18 war was characterised by tales of great human misery, both at the front and at home. Yet by many indicators, it was also a prosperous time, with near full employment, rising income levels, towards the later years of the conflict at least, and greater opportunities for women in the workforce. In the immediate aftermath of the end of hostilities, Britain as a whole looked to be making a welcome and speedy recovery. With wages continuing to rise and unemployment remaining low, the years 1919 and 1920 saw middle and lower class Britons enjoying better housing, affordable luxuries, and leisure time than ever before. Yet the image of a country gaily barrelling into the roaring 20s belies a reality of individuals, families, communities, and the nation still adjusting to the incredible loss of life and physical and mental injury bestowed by war, and the question of how to cope with the challenges of the immediate future. Perhaps inevitably, the financial boom was to be short-lived, and by 1921, with demobilisation complete, the economy struggled to cope with the increased demands on employment, food and housing. From March 1915 to the end of the war, unemployment never rose higher than 1.2%. Following a brief spike in late 1919, the figure was still under 3% during the summer of 1920. In May of 1921, it had risen to 23.4%. While that figure would again fall, at least until the effects of the Great Depression began to be felt in the early 1930s, unemployment levels would remain between 9 and 15% for the rest of the decade, much higher than the norms of the 1880s, 1890s or 1900s. The economic turmoil of the immediate post-war years were hastening and coinciding with greater social and political changes. In Westminster, the Labour Party grew from a small insurgent parliamentary group to minority government in 1923 to, in 1929, the largest party in the House of Commons. Trade unionism in the United Kingdom continued its pre-war development with increased membership, recognition and agitation, culminating in the general strike of 1926. Women's role in society and the political arena was also in flux, not least due to the opening of previously closed avenues of employment during the years of conflict, but more formally by the extension of the parliamentary franchise to women over the age of 30 in 1918, and on equal terms with men 10 years later. While no revolution was taking place, British society was changing. Cricket was to be buffered by those same winds, and like society as a whole, it often struggled to know how to adapt. Only 6 months and 5 days following the signing of the armistice to end the First World War, the county championship resumed, Lords and the Oval witnessing the first overs in the tournament for nearly 5 years, as Middlesex took on Nottinghamshire and Surrey hosted Somerset. The decision to resume the competition so soon was far from universally welcomed. Sidney Pardon, the editor of Wisden and a leading critic of the swift resumption of play, argued that counties should be allowed a year to make such arrangements as seemed best fitted to their own needs, while the game was being gradually brought back to its old footing. For the game truly to be restored to its old footing was no doubt an impossible dream given the events which had occurred since stumps were last drawn at Hove in 1914. As the war lengthened year on year, questions had been raised as to whether the game of cricket would ever regain its stature when peace finally broke out. Lord Harris had been the loudest voice to reassure those who cared that when the war ended, the game would re-establish itself in the heart of the English people. When peace finally came, the most immediate difficulty for the counties was finding enough players of sufficient quality to sustain a credible championship. Such difficulties were evident in that only 226 of the 489 men who had played first-class cricket in 1914 were to do the same in 1919, a loss of over half of all cricketers. Replacing those who had died, been injured, retired, or were simply no longer playing at the required standard, proved no easy task. The war had not only robbed first-class cricket of many good men who would have still been in their prime and called time on others through age, it also disrupted many of the proving grounds for young cricketers. The decision to halt all first-class cricket meant that no longer could promising youngsters take their first steps in county cricket, representative or university sides. Some league cricket, notably the Lancashire and Bradford leagues, did continue. But for the majority of men, opportunities to test their mettle in decent standard cricket was limited to, and dependent on selection for, intramilitary matches and the occasional exhibition game. In particular, first-class amateur cricket was hit hard. Young upper-class men, who formed a significant part of the amateur cricketing ranks, were disproportionately likely to be casualties of war. These were the Army's junior officers, first over the top to lead their men into battle. It is estimated that Eton alone lost more than 1,000 former pupils, some 20% of the Etonians who donned military uniform. For those that did not make their way to the front, the suspension of university cricket ended a common route into the first-class game. Public school matches continued throughout the conflict, but very few men in the history of the game had developed sufficiently by school leaving age to make the step straight into first-class cricket. Furthermore, the economic realities of the post-war period made it difficult for many amateurs to devote sufficient time to the game. The impact on the amateur cricketer would take a little time to dawn on the counties, as initially, in the rush to repopulate sides that had not operated in nearly 5 years, and with demobilisation still ongoing, necessity led to amateurs filling many of the places. In the first match for each county back in the 1914 season, amateurs had made up 29% of the cricketers on display. The equivalent figure in 1919 was 44%. That first season back, with many notable names now missing, the 15 counties Worcestershire chose not to participate faced a real challenge to consistently fill their 11s with players of a pre-war standard. No county was excluded from the problem, but numerically at least, Hampshire fared the worst, finding itself able, in 1919, to call on the services of only 8 of the 23 men who had worn their colours in the truncated season of 1914. The 22 others who were called into Hampshire's service on the championship's resumption were a mismatch of recalled county veterans or debutants with only school or local club experience. For example, selected for the county in August of 1919 were 48-year-old Ledger Hill, capped by both Hampshire and England, and 28-year-old Lionel Isherwood, with no notable previous cricketing experience. Both were to make only one appearance that season. Indeed, 17 of the 31 players appearing for Hampshire in 1919 would play in fewer than 5 matches. As the 1919 season drew to a close, the overwhelming feeling was one of relief. First-class cricket, despite all the challenges it faced, had returned, and for that alone the season was rightly viewed as a success. Wisden, in its 1920 edition, heralded, "The season of 1919 proved, beyond all question or dispute, that cricket had lost nothing of its attraction for the public." However, any expectation of an immediate recovery of the game's health to pre-war standards was going to prove misplaced. The patient was indeed alive, but would need some time to get back on his feet. The question of how that was to happen often split those who wanted to see the game to adapt to wider changes in society, and those who saw cricket's survival in a return to a strict orthodoxy, rooted in an imagined halcyon past. Of particular concern for the long-term prospects of the county game was the decline in attendances at matches. At first, all seemed well in this aspect. In the immediate post-war period, despite entrance prices still being inflated by the imposition of an entertainment tax, attendances swelled. Exact figures of match attendances are hard to find, but in 1921, a year in which a home Ashes series helped draw crowds, Yorkshire reported 284,677 paying spectators at their home matches. Inevitably, however, the end of the post-war boom had its effect, and while numbers fluctuated year on year, by 1929, Yorkshire's attendance figures had fallen to just over 135,000 and would only again pass 200,000 three times between 1927 and 1939. Counties such as Yorkshire, Lancashire and Surrey, relatively well off both financially and in terms of the crowds they could attract, were in a better position to ride any short-term storm than those such as Northamptonshire, who saw its annual income from gate receipts dip below the £2,000 mark at least seven times in the interwar period. These figures did not reflect well when compared to other forms of mass entertainment, particularly football. They also often did not compare favourably to some of the attendances at league cricket. In 1921, 1922, and the entire decade of the 1930s, spectator numbers for the Lancashire League topped those reported by Lancashire County Cricket Club and dwarfed those from some of the smaller counties. This trend added to the ability of some of the bigger league clubs to offer good terms to their professional players, provoked a brief period of hostility from the MCC towards the leagues, who were looked on by some as having become a rival and thus a threat to the vitality of the first-class game. Sidney Pardon, in the 1920 Wisden, wrote of the menace of the Lancashire and Yorkshire leagues, who constantly offer professionals better terms than did the counties and for far less work. Similar rumblings in the MCC concerning league teams enticing the better professionals away from the counties led the advisory committee to recommend that no player would be chosen for any representative match or overseas tour unless they made themselves available to their county whenever they were selected. In 1921, Lord Hawke went one step further by publicly castigating clubs in the Lancashire League for poaching county professionals. Concerns over the success of the leagues were not simply a case of pounds, shillings and pence. There were also fears for the traditional spirit of the game, and it cannot be a coincidence that they came to light at a time when society was changing around it. Once cricket had resumed after the armistice, its leaders were concerned to try and ensure the game not just survived, but maintained its pre-war character, traditions and class distinctions. As such, the popular and often populist league cricket was frowned upon as an unwanted example of the game where, according to the Manchester Guardian, bad strokes were cheered just as lustily as good strokes. This theme of a decline in the correct technique on behalf of players was echoed in many quarters. Archie MacLaren, in his 1924 book Cricket Old and New, warned budding cricketers of the perils lurking in innovation and passionately bemoaned the methods of many modern batsmen who, in their eagerness to experiment, are getting away from those immutable first principles which men like W.G. Grace and F.S. Jackson, both innovators in their day, never for a moment departed from. MacLaren's warnings were embraced by The Observer, which asked, "If all is well with English cricket, why is Rhodes now, on his own confession, an industrious shadow of his former self, still one of the most successful bowlers playing? How is it that Quaife, a man over 50, could say that he found run-getting last season easier than ever before?" Neville Cardus, writing in the Manchester Guardian, was particularly concerned with the loss of the attacking play that had become associated with the pre-war golden era of the game. He wrote of the interwar period, "In these 20 seasons, I saw a change in cricket. It is not fanciful, I think, to say that a national game is influenced by the spirit and atmosphere of the period. In 1920, cricket retained much of the gusto and free personal gesture of the years before the war of 1914 to 1918. Then, as disillusion increased and the nation's life contracted, and the catchword safety first became familiar, and a sense of insecurity gathered, cricket itself lost confidence and character." Equally as alarming for the great and the good of English cricket were the forces of social change, which, for many of the fearful gentry, had reached its zenith in revolution in Russia, but was exemplified by the rise in the trade union movement and Labour Party in Britain. Emancipation of the working man and the associated threat to the British class structure was of no small matter to a sport which had so embraced and embodied social distinction. Thus, in the post-war period, talk of Bolshevism abound. Lord Harris, when on a mission during this period to ensure that counties only engaged the services of those players who met the MCC's strict qualification regulations, argued that Bolshevism is rampant and seeks to abolish all rules, and this year cricket has not escaped its attack. This, then, made the ongoing debates about allowing professionals to captain counties or international sides all the more apposite. The pretense of the purely amateur captain was maintained throughout the period, even though cracks were glaringly obvious. By 1933, 13 counties had used professionals as captain when no amateur had been available. At Yorkshire, Wilfred Rhodes was widely known to be the de facto leader, if never officially captain. And even England, in 1926, was led by Jack Hobbs, albeit temporarily, when Arthur Carr was taken unwell. Suggestions to improve the appeal of the game came from many observers and were a common topic of debate in cricketing circles. Proposed innovations included restricting the number of professionals in a team to 3 or 4 to encourage attacking amateur play, shortening the boundary, penalising batting sides for every maiden bowled, and even banning left-handed batsmen. While all of those were dismissed out of hand, some that took root in this time were later adopted. The 8-ball over used in Australia was proposed as a means of packing more play into a day, and, supported by notable figures such as Pelham Warner, was eventually implemented in English cricket in 1939, though the change was abandoned after the Second World War. Modifications to the leg-before-wicket rule to encourage a more even contest between bat and ball, and thus increase the chance of a result in 3 days, by allowing dismissals from balls which pitched outside off stump, were discussed and eventually, in 1935, implemented. Also, in an attempt to increase the likelihood of a result, the MCC Advisory Committee discussed lengthening the number of days test matches were allowed to run. When the committee voted to maintain the 3-day test, with only the representative from Lancashire dissenting, the former England batsman Archie MacLaren responded with a stinging rebuke in the Manchester Guardian, accusing Yorkshire, and by implication Lord Hawke, president of the county and former president of the MCC, of placing undue pressure on the rest of the committee and stifling proper debate. Hawke had been prominent in opposing any proposal that tests be allowed to play to a finish, saying the idea was absurd and would change the whole spirit of English cricket. During the early 1920s, the one aspect of the game that cast a long shadow over English cricket and provided a constant reminder of the difficulties that face the sport was the disappointing performance of the national team. Test match cricket had laid dormant since March 1914, and the Ashes uncontested for almost a decade when the England team, under the banner of the MCC, took sail for Australia in late 1920. If county teams were still in a process of recovery, managing the end days of many of their established players while searching for new talent, It was inevitable that this would impact on the national side, and so it proved. With the domestic games still so unsound, the MCC had been understandably reluctant to resume international competition and had turned down an Australian invitation to send a touring side the previous winter. However, apparently bowled over by the level of Australian enthusiasm, the MCC relented when the invitation was issued the following year. With not a huge wealth of obvious new top-class talent to choose from, particularly in the bowling department, it was a side of largely familiar names who took the field at Sydney in late December 1920 for the first test. Led by the veteran amateur J.W.H.T. Douglas, the 11 in that first test featured only four debutants, and the remaining seven players boasted an average age of 36 and a total of 137 test matches under their collective belt. They faced a younger Australian side with extremes of experience. Seven debutants played, while the other four men shared 96 test caps between them. It was, in the words of Wisden, a disaster. The five test matches were horribly one-sided affairs, and the Australians ran out winners by 377 runs, an innings of 91 runs, 119 runs, 8 wickets, and 9 wickets, respectively. In particular, England's bowling attack was found wanting, allowing the Australians to score 589 more runs than England over the course of the series, while taking 17 fewer wickets. A glance at the Test Series bowling figures makes for grim reading even on the true Australian pitches. Excepting Rockley Wilson, who played only one test, finishing with match figures of 3 for 36, the series averages of England's frontline bowlers were 34, 41, 58, 59, 61 and 66. The batting, which promised to be England's strongest suit, fired in fits and starts. From the 10 innings played, only one team score of over 400 and two in excess of 300 were posted. If Jack Hobbs's exploits were ignored, the individual returns looked mediocre, a century apiece from Makepeace and Russell, and four players emerging with test averages over 30, but under 40. If batsmen returned boasting higher tour figures, it was only through scores against state and local sides. Hobbs, as so often the case, was a class apart. While not near his best return in terms of centuries and 50s, 2 and 1 respectively, he ended the tour with a test average in excess of 50 and a run aggregate of over 500, some 150 runs more than his nearest teammate. John Berry Hobbs, the master, born in Cambridge in 1882, was destined to become not just one of the great batsmen, but easily the most dominant English cricketer since W.G. had bestrode the game. Having a father who made his living from cricket, John Senior was on the staff at Fenner's and later groundsman and umpire at Jesus College, the bat and ball was a part of Jack's life from an early age. It also gave him an early and solid grounding in the correct techniques of batsmanship, and particularly the importance of a straight bat, a principle drilled into young Jack by his father. Such strong foundations allowed Hobbs to develop the batting game that was not only pleasing to the eye, but would eventually give him mastery of all types of bowling on all kinds of wicket. Appreciation of his skills came quickly, and from the very best, making his first-class debut for Surrey against the Gentlemen of England in 1905. The opposing captain was reported to have stroked his beard and commented, "He's gonna be a good 'un." The captain, of course, was W.G. Grace. The interlude in Hobbs's career brought by war, he served in the Royal Flying Corps, changed him as a player. Before 1914, he was a dynamic batsman, quick to the ball, playing with attacking intent, using his wrist to dispatch the ball to all parts of the ground. For Arlott, he typified the modern school, quick-footed, forward or back, dealing with late swing, leg theory, or the googly by fresh methods, involving particularly sophisticated onside techniques. When Jack returned to the field of play in 1919, now a veteran of 36 years of age, and soon plagued by a serious injury and illness, his daring spirit had been somewhat tempered. In its place was a classical, graceful mastery of his game. For some, while he remained the foremost practitioner of the art of batting, something had been lost. For his England colleague Frank Woolley, there were two jacks, the pre- and the post-war jack. The real one, according to Woolley, was the pre-war. Even Hobbs himself once commented that he would wish to be remembered for the way he batted pre-war. Such laments, however, should only be viewed as comment on the style of his batsmanship, because in terms of his prowess, skill and run-getting, neither age nor injury would dull Jack Hobbs's dominance. So prolific was the run-scoring during Hobbs's first-class career, it becomes hard to find parallel in the English game. Only once in his career, during his Surrey debut season of 1905, can he have been said to have had a serious run of bad form. Of course, some years brought better return than others, but following his 1905 average of 25, Hobbs would never let it dip below 30 again, and during a career spanning 26 war-interrupted seasons, he would post a home season average in excess of 50 16 times, and over 60 8 times. His standout year was 1925, in which he scored over 3,000 runs, including 16 centuries, finishing with an average of 70.32. Or it might be in 1926, where in 7 fewer innings than the previous season, he racked up 2,949 runs, an average of over 77, with a high score of 316 not out. Or it might be in 1928, with its season-ending average of 82, including 12 centuries and 10 50s from just 38 innings. Or it might just be one of his others. When the master put away his pads for the last time in 1934, he could reflect on a first-class career that had produced 61,760 runs at an average of 50.7 and brought the watching public a phenomenal 199 centuries, 100 of them struck after the age of 40. His career total remains unbeaten today. During his illustrious career, the cricketer was moved to comment that, "Since Test matches were inaugurated, England has possessed many good men to open the innings, but never a better than Hobbs." With apologies to Messrs. Sutcliffe, Hutton, Boycott, Gooch and Cook, the same could be said today. Such is his legacy that in the year 2000, Hobbs was deservedly named as one of Wisden's five cricketers of the 20th century. Hobbs and his fellow tourists arrived home at the end of the ill-fated Winter Ashes series in 1921, knowing that it was only a matter of weeks before they had a chance of revenge on the old enemy. The Australians remained the toughest of all opponents, but on home pitches, with English conditions, a better contest was expected. By the time the England players trudged from the field at the close of the first test, defeated by 10 wickets, those hopes had been well and truly dashed. The first blow suffered by England occurred 3 weeks before the two sides were due to meet for the first time. Australia were taking on a remarkably strong LG Robinson 11, which featured some of the men who were expected to represent the full England side later in the summer, and Jack Hobbs was proving to be the main obstacle in the way of the tourists once again. Midway through the second morning, Hobbs, not out on 85, looked to be marching to yet another century, when taking off for a run, a reoccurrence of an old thigh injury pulled him up sharply. His batting partner, Valance Jupp, said he could hear the muscle snap. It was a cruel blow to Hobbs and to any slim hopes England had of reclaiming the famous urn. Without their leading run scorer, it was perhaps predictable that the first test ended in a comfortable tourist victory, England failing to reach 150 in either innings. It was also a Hobbsless side that succumbed in a similar fashion in the second test, losing by 8 wickets, where only a pair of scores in the 90s by the gifted left-hander Frank Woolley gave home supporters any reason to cheer. The third test, at Leeds, offered a glimmer of promise with a fit again Hobbs returning to the starting lineup. That promise turned to disaster on the first afternoon, when the returning master became ill and was under the surgeon's knife for an emergency appendectomy before he had faced the ball. Hobbs was out for the rest of the series, and England slumped to a 219-run defeat. To few people's surprise, the Ashes were to return to Australia that summer. What was most disappointing was the contest, if you could call it that, had been so one-sided, and the result decided in the bare minimum of matches. Sidney Pardon, in his Wisden editor's notes, concluded that there had never been a season so disheartening as that of 1921. England was not merely beaten, but overwhelmed. At Lord's, the contrast was humiliating. The Ashes gone, the final two tests were at least not to repeat the embarrassment of the first three. With some help from the weather, both finished in draws and even saw three English centuries, one from Phil Mead and two from opener Jack Russell. If these last two results saved some face, they did little to compensate for a sobering 9 months for English cricket. Much like Hobbs, English cricket was clearly still in recovery. There would, at least, be some time for both Hobbs and England to attempt their inevitably linked returns. England was not due to play Test cricket until late December 1921, when an MCC party was to travel to South Africa. For Hobbs, his international recuperation was to last even longer, as never the most enthusiastic tourist due to chronic seasickness. A combination of family ties, business commitments, and lingering doubts over the effect of a long tour on a body that was still not fully recovered from his illness led him to turn down the invitation to return to the Test arena. Despite missing some key players, there was optimism that England could use the next winter tour as an opportunity to return to winning ways. The South Africans may have been playing in home conditions, but it was widely viewed that they were the weakest of the three test-playing nations and that the tourists would prevail. English hearts sunk then when the news returned from Johannesburg shortly after Christmas 1922 that the South Africans had taken the first test by 168 runs. Their captain, the able Herbie Taylor, hitting a fine 176 in their second innings. England had still not won a test match since the outbreak of war. That streak would be broken in the New Year match at Newlands, Cape Town. It was a victory for England, but by no means a convincing one, as chasing 173 to win, they stumbled over the line by one wicket, numbers 9 and 11 at the crease. Matches 3 and 4 were draws, leaving the fate of the series resting on the final rubber at Durban. A timeless match to be played until a result was secured. On the sixth day, it finished. An 109-run victory for the MCC, thanks to centuries in both innings by Jack Russell. It was the first time that feat had been achieved in Test matches, and was all the more remarkable given that Russell had been unwell during the second innings, forcing him to give up his opener's berth for a late entrance at number 6. The series had been secured, but while the result was celebrated, few took the news as a reason for renewed optimism. As Wisden argued, the trip, though in many ways highly satisfactory, did little to restore the damaged prestige of English cricket and afforded no real compensation for the crushing defeats so recently inflicted by Australia. A few, though not many, of the side returned with their reputations enhanced. On the batting front, Russell had the most to feel proud of, finishing the Test series as England's top scorer and an average of 62 to add to his record-making centuries in the final match. Mead was the only other player to average over 40, and only one more, Captain Frank Mann, could boast a return in excess of 30. Of the bowlers, Hampshire's Alex Kennedy dominated the figures, taking 31 of the 80 wickets to fall to a bowler at an average of 19. English cricket entered the 1924 season with any hopes overshadowed by the reality of still how short the available talent was compared to the perpetual yardstick of the Australians. There had been no test matches for England in the summer of 1923, and no overseas tour the following winter. What representative cricket there was, particularly gentlemen versus players and an August test trial, left Wisden editor Pardon unimpressed. "One had an uneasy feeling," he complained, "that if our best men went on like that, the prospect of beating Australia in the near future, either away or at home, must be remote." He did, however, concede that there had been improvements both in the English county bowling stocks, Maurice Tate, Roy Kilner and Arthur Gilligan in particular, and the standard of amateur batting. It was unfair on the South African party that arrived in England in the spring of 1924 ahead of a test series that the summer matches were largely seen as prologue. An away Ashes series scheduled for winter 1924-5 loomed on the horizon, and the ability of the national side to compete with the Australians was the prism through which all cricket was viewed. Anyhow, having defeated South Africa in the recent series on their own soil, and with the promise of the return of Hobbs, an England victory was widely expected. For the South Africans, the build-up to the first test started badly and went downhill from there. A key culprit was the British weather. The South African team was young and inexperienced, and used to playing on the matting wickets of their home, needed all the time in the middle they could get to adjust to English conditions. In that respect, the fact that the early summer of 1924 was exceptionally wet dealt the tourists two blows. They not only faced an unfortunate amount of time sat in the changing room watching the puddles gather on the outfield, but when they did manage to cross the boundary rope, the South Africans found themselves faced with wet, then sticky wickets in which to face bowlers who revelled in such conditions. In their seven matches against county opposition before the first test, the tourists finished with five draws and two defeats, including a thumping loss at the hands of Lancashire by an innings and 78 runs, potential England bowlers Cecil Parkin and Dick Tildesley taking all 20 wickets between them. The only cheer for the luckless South Africans came in victories over Scotland and Cambridge University, and a couple of centuries from the bat of 45-year-old veteran Dave Norse. Their early experience of England was summed up by their final warm-up game against Oxford University. Fewer than 58 overs were possible, and the match was abandoned before the visitors were able to bat. The Observer noted that since international teams began visiting these shores, no touring side can ever have undergone so disheartening an experience. The weather, though, had not finished playing tricks on the South Africans, and having served up muggy atmospheres and sticky batting tracks to adjust to, when the teams gathered in Birmingham for the first test, the sun decided to shine and the wicket quickly dried out. Those build-up fixtures also sent alarm bells ringing in the South African camp regarding the quality and suitability of their bowling attack to English wickets. Sid Pegler, as expected, was the tourist's main threat, and took 38 wickets in the warm-ups at an average of under 15. The other leading bowlers, Claude Carter, Cess Dixon, Jimmy Blackenberg and Buster Newpen, were certainly no disgrace. Each took wickets and emerged with a respectable average. But the lack of any pace, exceptional spin or consistency of length gave the impression of an attack which lacked penetration and, according to the Times, was too much of a muchness. With the first day of the first test match fast approaching, concern that their bowling attack would not be up to the task prompted the South African leadership to start looking around for alternatives. Understandably, international level South African qualified bowlers who could get to Birmingham in time were in short supply. One name did emerge though. George Parker, a 25-year-old fast bowler from Cape Town, who had been in England for 4 years and was currently plying his trade for Eccleshill in the Bradford League. With only one warm-up fixture left before the test, Parker was summoned and pressed into action for his first-class debut against Oxford University. The decision looked vindicated as Parker bowled well on a surface that was not obviously ideal for a quick and was unlucky not to take more than his 4 for 34 before rain caused a premature finish, the usually keen South African catching letting him down on four occasions. 3 days later, Parker would make his second first-class appearance in the test match. For England, The choice of side looked a more settled issue, at least to the extent that the selection committee had clearly made up its mind some time in advance. Less than 3 weeks before the start of the South African series, a test trial match between an England 11 and the rest was organised to give the selectors an opportunity to see their options. As a spectacle, the trial gave spectators a close finish, England running out winners by 3 wickets. But in terms of individual performances, it was an unremarkable game. For the England 11, only 2 scores in excess of 50 were posted. Percy Fender scoring 81 in the first innings and Frank Woody making 72 in the second. Whereas 3 were conjured by batsmen for the rest, Holmes, McBride and Chapman notching the runs. Wickets were shared around both sides, with only England's uncapped fast-medium bowler Morris Tate particularly catching the eye for his consistent economy. Nothing in the performances had made the selectors change their mind about their best side, and 10 of the 11 England men were named in the test squad announcement. Missing was the unfortunate Jack Hearn, who had injured his hand whilst in the field, and his place was given to Percy Chapman, a reward for his runs in the trial. A 12th name of Ernest Tilsley was added to complete the squad, despite the fact that he had not participated for either side in the trial match. He would be 12th man for the test. The balance of the 12 was 8 professionals and 4 amateurs, and from the latter group, Arthur Gilligan was appointed captain. Saturday, 14th of June, 1924. Pressure was on the England 11 who donned their whites in the Edgbaston changing room on that dry morning. They were expected to win, and win well. "Unless we can beat the South Africans very comfortably," opined the Times, "it will be of little use to send a team to Australia next winter." Initial omens were not so encouraging for the English men. The weather that had denied their opponents good batting wickets that early summer had changed, and the sun was beginning to beat down on the pitch. Accordingly, when Arthur Gilligan and Herbie Taylor met for the toss and the coin fell the South Africans' way, the England captain would have been expecting a morning in the field. Taylor had other ideas, and to the surprise of many in the initially small Birmingham crowd, he invited England to bat, or, in Frank Woolley's word, "put us in on a plummin." Taylor's decision had no doubt been prompted by his experiences of the past few weeks, and given that the Birmingham pitch had been under water only a week before, he would have been forgiven for thinking that any stickiness remaining would be present on the first morning and not thereafter. The emergency call-up of Parker had demonstrated the lack of confidence in the tourists' attack, and so Taylor would have been keen to secure for his men any assistance, however small, from the conditions as he could. Alternatively, it may have been simply that he did not fancy his batsmen surviving long against the likes of Gilligan, Tate and Parkin on a wicket that might be still drying out. The decision was not universally derided. Former England batsman turned journalist Archie McLaren, for one, defended Taylor's move as quite understandable, as, had he chosen to bat on the drying wicket, the game by now might have been virtually all over. Plum Warner, writing in The Cricketer, concurred, "Had I won the toss, I should have acted as he did. Taylor had everything to gain and nothing to lose by putting England in." Whatever the reason Taylor had for inserting England, it soon began to look like an error of judgment. The sun was quickly drying out the surface and producing a true yet soft and slow track that was good for batting. And if the pitch was not going to give the South Africans' fragile attack any help, then the last man they needed to see strolling out to the middle, bat in hand, was Jack Hobbs. It was a significant moment. Not only was Hobbs back, fit and firing, for the first time since the Ashes tour of 1920-21, but as he walked to the wicket, he did so in the presence of a new opening partner, Herbert Sutcliffe. Born 24th November 1894, Herbert Sutcliffe was destined to become a Yorkshire and England legend. He was a stylish batsman whose off-drive, it was said, wore a silk hat and whose hook was a ready response to the aggressive intent of any bumper. Style and grit were not mutually exclusive, and Herbert succeeded as much through determination as flair. On his death in 1978, Wisden was prompted to reminisce that Herbert never knew a season of failure, and one would find it difficult to argue with that contention. The demands of war meant that Sutcliffe was aged 24 before he could make his first-class debut for his native Yorkshire in 1919. As debut seasons go, it was impressive. 1,839 runs at an average of a shade under 45, including five centuries. It propelled him far enough into the national cricketing consciousness that still a novice, he was named one of Wisden's Cricketers of the Year for 1920. The following 2 years, however, did not see Herbert make the strides that many expected of him. His figures remained respectable, but nothing more. Averages in the low 30s, and in 1921, no first-class century to call his own. The 1922 season, however, started a remarkable run of form, and from then until 1935, Herbert would pass 2,000 runs every domestic season and posted in excess of 3,000 in 1931 and 1932, finishing the former of those years with a first-class average of 96.96. His importance to 20th century cricket, however, was not just a matter of runs and averages, but rather the new breed of professional he represented. Neville Cardus, writing in 1947, described Sutcliffe thus: "His hair resplendent with brillantine, and wore immaculate flannels, and on the whole comported with an elegance which in the Yorkshire 11 was unique and apocryphal. The advent into cricket and into the Yorkshire 11 of all places of a Herbert Sutcliffe was a sign of the time. The old order was not changing, it was going. The pole was fallen, young boys and girls level now with men. Captains of cricket were henceforth called skipper by all self-respecting professionals, never sir. Our Sutcliffes and Hammonds, with their tailors obviously in Savile Row, have taken us far, far beyond echo of Billy Barnes and his rough, horny-handed company of paid cricketers of the 80s and 90s, savages born too soon to benefit from Mr. Arnold Foster's acts of education." On the cricket field, Sutcliffe would become synonymous with the opening partnerships he contributed so much to. For Yorkshire, originally, Sutcliffe and Holmes, and later, Sutcliffe and Hutton. For England, starting at Edgbaston in 1924, Hobbs and Sutcliffe. Hobbs, the senior partner on that day, passed on some simple advice to his new colleague: play your own game. Four words, Sutcliffe remembered. They counted for much. At Edgbaston, the sun shone, and this new English opening partnership began to make hay. The slow wicket gave the batsmen plenty of time to see the ball, and the bowlers little assistance, calling into doubt not only the South African decision at the toss, but also their selection policy, which had included the quick debutant Parker at the expense of players more suited to a slow wicket such as Carter or Dixon. Taylor did what he could with the attack at his disposal. Parker opened with Sig Pegler, and their initial overs were encouraging. Pegler, though restricted by an ankle injury, tested Hobbs with some well-disguised leg breaks, and Parker initially stuck to a good length, even finding a little swing. With disciplined bowling and a sluggish outfield restricting the boundaries, runs were slow to come, though equally neither bowler truly threatened a breakthrough against solid batting technique. Half an hour of settling in was enough for Sutcliffe, and he started to milk the tiring Parker, hitting him for a couple of sumptuous leg-side boundaries. Taylor rang the changes to mixed effect. Blackenberg on for Parker bowled a respectable length, but it was when Newpen relieved Pegler that the fun started. Buster Newpen was a fast, medium right-arm bowler who gained a reputation for being deadly on the matting wickets of his homeland, who could struggle on turf. Sutcliffe took an instant liking to the Johannesburger, scoring quickly off him with cuts and leg glances, including an enormous six over square leg. The captain then turned once more to the speed of Parker, who unwisely decided to test the batsman's abilities against the shorter delivery to a packed leg-side field. The ploy bothered Hobbs little, and he joined in the run feast with relish. At lunch, England had reached 122 without loss, Sutcliffe on 61, to Hobbs's 57. News of a burgeoning partnership between the master, Hobbs, and his new partner must have spread as the crowd had noticeably increased in size. Some estimates put the numbers at 10,000 or even 12,000, though official gate receipts had it nearer 7. A fairly small number for the first test of the summer, and certainly affected by the relatively expensive half-crown admission charge. If the people of Birmingham were hoping to settle down to a masterclass from the pair, they were to be disappointed, as with only 14 more runs added to the total, Sutcliffe departed to a swinging Yorker from Parker for 64, his first test wicket. Frank Woolley, the talented Kent left-hander, joined Hobbs and ensured that the rate of scoring was maintained, timing the ball perfectly from the off. Their partnership was to be brief, however, as with the score on 164, Hobbs was trapped in front for 76, playing across a length delivery from Blackenberg. Next in was Patsy Hendren, who seemed content to play an anchor role to Woolley's assault on the South African attack. Aided by a now dry wicket and increasingly erratic bowling, the Kent man knocked the ball to all parts of the ground until, having made 64, he was surprised to see the umpire's finger raised after a ball from Parker clipped his thigh on the way through to the wicketkeeper. Hendren continued in his own way, accumulating runs as partners came and went. When he was finally dismissed to a smart catch at fine leg for 74, the score had moved along to 356 for 6, and by the close of play, to 398 for 7, all batsmen except Chapman, shaped wildly and had his off stump taken, having made a respectable contribution to the score. Yet not all spectators were happy with England's display. Hendren was a particular target for criticism for his cautious approach, cheered sarcastically by a section of the crowd for often reportedly to have dawdled in the midst of luscious half volleys. The Manchester Guardian's Neville Cardus was particularly scathing, exempting only Hobbs, Sutcliffe, Woolley and Fender from his ire. The rest, he harumphed, did not look grand enough for the occasion. Our batsmen, he argued, must carry themselves like masters and not like opportunists. Although they fielded keenly, the weakness of the South African bowling had been exposed after lunch, with Pegler the only man seemingly able to exert any control. The novice Parker found the demands of Test cricket exhausting, maintaining line and length over an extended period impossible, grotesquely erratic, according to Cardus, and his pace greatly diminished as the day wore on. Having bowled unchanged for more than 3 hours, he was spent, and late into the evening session took his jumper from the umpire and headed off the field without a word. His captain, Taylor, went to see what the matter was. "I'm simply whacked. I can't bowl another ball," replied the debutant, who didn't return again that day. Nevertheless, Parker had been the most successful of the attack, taking 5 of the wickets to fall. Even though, at times, he seemed uncertain how to proceed, Frank Woolley recalled that at one point the South African had walked down the pitch to ask, "My field placed all right, Frank?" Understandably taken aback by the question, Woolley replied, "Yes, I think it seems just right." Parker thanked him and walked back to his mark. Monday, 16th of June, 1924. Sunday, having been a rest day, the players returned to Edgbaston on the Monday morning to resume England's first innings. Given an extra day to feel the heat of the June sun, the wicket looked to have hardened some more. England's wicketkeeper George Wood certainly thought the pitch should give some more help to the quicker bowlers, reporting before play started that it looked faster by a yard and a half. That the remaining batsmen added only another 40 runs to the overnight score, however, was less to do with any changing conditions and more with England's desire to move the match along. With all batsmen under instruction to hit out, Gilligan was the first to go, bowled by Pegler for 13. Wood quickly followed, also castled, this time by a Parker delivery that he was early on. Finally, the innings was wrapped up when Roy Kilner played too soon to a dipping Pegler full toss and was caught and bowled. All out for 438, a record for England against South Africa. Parker finished with 6 for 152, the other wickets evenly shared between Pegler and Blackenberg. It was time to see what life the now dry Edgbaston pitch could offer the home attack. The South African innings would be opened by captain Herbie Taylor and the free-scoring 23-year-old Bob Catterall. The young South African took strike, and the innings got off the mark immediately with a no-ball from Arthur Gilligan. Returning to the top of his run, the England captain came in to bowl the first legitimate delivery of the innings and promptly knocked Catterall's leg stump out of the ground. 1 for 1. What followed was a remarkable spell of bowling from Gilligan and Maurice Tait, both bowling fast and Gilligan regularly landing a perfect yorker. According to Tait, who had seen much of Gilligan's bowlers over the past 4 years, he had never seen his captain bowl so well. Fred Susskind, next to the crease, improved on his predecessor's performance by getting off the mark with a 2 and then keeping the strike with a single from the last ball of Gilligan's over. That was as good as it got for Susskind, and facing Tait's first ball in Test cricket, he planted an in-swinging half-volley into the hands of Roy Kilner at short leg. A single off the sixth ball of the over from the incoming Dave Norse meant that he would be facing Gilligan's next over, and 6 balls later, Norse was heading back to the pavilion. LBW for 1. 6 for 3. As the carnage of the first 3 overs unfolded, Taylor had watched aghast from the non-striker's end, yet to face a delivery. Now joined by his vice-captain, Mick Kamail, the two experienced batsmen attempted to stem the flow and began building a partnership. Their efforts lasted precisely 8 runs, 7 of them scored by the skipper, before Taylor was cleaned up by an exceptional ball from Tait, bowled neck and crop, spread-eagling his stumps all over the landscape. Only 6 runs later, Jimmy Blackenberg suffered an identical fate and was back in the hutch for 4. It would be the second highest score by a South African in their first innings, only beaten by Taylor's 7. 20 for 5. Now it was Kamail's fate to watch the unfolding calamity from the relative serenity of the non-striker's end. With the score on 23, Nummy Dean and Buster Newpen were seen off by consecutive deliveries from Gilligan. Sid Pegler then did his best to provide the England captain with a test hat-trick when he played around a ball that narrowly missed the stumps. Still, he would not hang around for much longer, seeing his wicket rearranged by Tait for a duck. 24 for 8. Only 2 questions remained. Could South Africa avoid setting a new record for their lowest total in test cricket? And who, out of Gilligan and Tait, would finish with the best return? It was to be Gilligan that finished ahead in that particular duel, knocking over Tommy Ward for 1 and trapping George Parker in front for a duck. Kamail, having faced 22 balls, remained unbeaten, with a solitary run to his name. They had avoided the ignominy of setting a new lowest score, though only by the feat of equalling it. 30 all out. For the South Africans, it was a cricketing embarrassment. Not only had all of their players failed to reach double digits on a pitch which had given up over 400 runs in the England innings, but with 1 bye, 7 leg byes and 3 no balls, the 11 batsmen had mustered only 19 earned runs between them. The whole innings had taken only 48 minutes and was wrapped up before lunch. So few deliveries had been necessary to see off the South African batsmen that the ball, which would find a home in Arthur Gilligan's study, still clearly showed the maker's name. There were some attempts at mitigation by the assembled press pack, mainly by ruminating on a change in the state of the pitch. Archie McLaren, who had, in that morning's Daily Express, unfortunately proclaimed that the South Africans, I feel sure, will not be skittled out on Monday for a negligible score, was moved to argue that the wicket was faster this morning, and the heavy roller which Taylor was bound to put on brought the deuce to the top. The ball was certain to turn for 20 minutes, especially with the new ball. An assessment with which England's captain concurred. All I did was hold the seam upright, claimed Gilligan, and the ball moved violently off the pitch either way. Others, including Pelham Warner and the Daily Mirror's correspondent, tried to give the visitors some solace in the undeniable fact that they were undercooked in terms of preparation and had, in their warm-up matches, not once experienced a pitch in character like this one. Nothing, of course, could disguise or excuse such a total collapse, but the one thing that all could agree on was the brilliance of the performances of Messrs Gilligan and Tait. Both had seemed unplayable, getting pace off the surface and causing the ball to break, often dramatically. Wicketkeeper George Wood said that he had never before seen the ball move as much as it did from Gilligan that day. Their figures, impressive as they were, did not flatter. Gilligan, despite having bowled while strapped up after having been hit earlier in the match, finished with 6 wickets for only 7 runs. Tait with 4 for 12. It may have been his international debut, but the pairing of Tait with Arthur Gilligan was a familiar one on the county circuit, having been bothering batsmen up and down the land as Sussex's opening bowling partnership. Despite being only 6 months older and having made his first class debut 7 years later than Tait, Arthur Gilligan had quickly established himself as the senior of the two cricketers. A large part of that stemmed from the fact that as an amateur, Gilligan was not only held in higher esteem by the cricketing establishment, but was in line to be offered the captaincy of both his county and national side, positions which Tait, for all his ability, would have been highly unlikely to achieve. As with so many talented cricket-mad boys of his generation and class, Gilligan was to find the well-worn path from public school to university to county cricket interrupted by war. Arthur had entered Pembroke College, Cambridge in 1914, but within a year found himself at the Western Front, serving as a captain in the Lancashire Fusiliers. When the war eventually came to an end, he returned to Pembroke to continue his education and cricketing pursuits. While his overall figures on the cricket field for Cambridge during the 1919 season were unremarkable, Gilligan's timing was impeccable, and he put in a couple of notable performances at key moments to bring his name to the attention of county committees. A remarkable attacking century while batting at number 11 against Sussex, and 5 wickets on the last day of that year's Varsity match at Lord's, turned heads on the Surrey committee, and Gilligan had made his county debut by the end of the season. Gilligan's first steps into county cricket with Surrey would prove brief and unspectacular, but he would make a little more progress the next season, this time with Sussex. The invitation from Hove had been a most welcome one, as Arthur had been a supporter of the county as a boy, and thanks to qualification via a Sussex-born grandmother, his brother Harold was already representing the team. He made his Sussex debut in 1920, and pledged his cricketing attention to the county full-time in 1921, having left Cambridge to take up a position in his father's firm. His bowling figures in those years are respectable, if expensive, and the overall view of Gilligan was of a quick, yet patchy bowler, and a dashing, if vulnerable, batsman, who only really excelled in his fielding at mid-off. Though not setting the cricketing world alight with his performances, Gilligan was a Sussex regular and an amateur, the combination of which led to him being offered the county captaincy at the start of the 1922 season. It was a pivotal point in his career that either inspired or coincided with an upturn in his results with both bat and ball, scoring close to 1,000 runs and taking over 100 wickets in that season at an impressively low average. As a captain, he also drew admirers for the attractive nature of Sussex cricket under his charge, if not, perhaps, always for their results. His ascent to the England captaincy began at the end of 1922, when he was picked to tour South Africa by the MCC and instantly installed as vice-captain under Frank Mann. He may have been a debutant, but he was also one of the few amateurs, and with the main alternative, Percy Fender, having developed a habit of irritating the cricketing authorities, incidents attached themselves to Fender like barnacles to a ship, according to his biographer Richard Streeton. The genial Gilligan's position was assured. Throughout 1923, Gilligan continued to grow in stature as a bowler, and comfortably achieving the feat of 1,000 runs and 100 wickets in the season, he was, by the start of 1924, one of the best fast bowlers in England, if not the world. Quick and, according to Wisden, while his action may have been slightly low, he was accurate and regarded it as a cardinal sin to bowl short. His performances in 1923 led him to being named one of Wisden's five bowlers of the year, though in a rather churlish tribute it noted that he was not among the great fast bowlers, but, it conceded, he is a very good one, combining with the right temperament and tireless energy just the extra bit of pace that to many batsmen is so distasteful. When Frank Mann was deemed too old and out of form to be reappointed England captain for the 1924 home series against South Africa, Gilligan was once again the man for the MCC panel, and at Birmingham he led the team for the first time. Unfortunately for Gilligan, his performance in that match was to be the peak of his career. Between the first and second tests, representing the gentleman at the Oval, he was struck near his heart by a rising delivery from Frank Pearson. Unwisely, by his own admission, Gilligan continued in the game, scoring a second innings century. The damage done, whether physical, psychological or both, was lasting, and Arthur Gilligan was never the same bowler again. He continued as England captain until the end of the next Ashes tour and played for Sussex for another 8 years, but he had lost his mojo, never, after 1924, taking more than 100 wickets in a season, or achieving them at an average of lower than 20. If Gilligan had been one of England's two best quicks, the other was his Sussex partner, Morris Tate, who was destined to become one of the game's greats. A well-liked and light-hearted man with unusually large feet, Morris, known as Chubb, had been born into the world of cricket as the son of Fred Tate, a Sussex professional who had represented England. Despite such heritage, Morris showed little aptitude for the game as a child, recalling that, according to his family, he was an absolutely dud cricketer, and even as late as the age of 15, it was thought that his only chance in sport was as a soccer fullback. Regardless of these apparent limitations, and having played little organised cricket as a youth, his father was still asked by the Sussex committee if he would send Morris to Hove for a trial. He was 15, had recently left school, and had begun work as a fitter. In the nets, the younger Tate quickly demonstrated his severe limitations with the bat, but Arthur Millward, the ex-Worcestershire professional who was coaching at Sussex, saw in Morris a useful off-break bowler and took him on as a ground staff bowler at £1 a week. 2 years later, aged only 17, Morris made his county debut away to Northants, batting at number 11. Morris had received very little formal training, but had clearly picked up much from watching his father, as in his approach to the wicket and bowling style, he was clearly a chip off the old block. After one county appearance in 1912 and four in 1913, he was farmed out to Eastbourne in early 1914 to gain more experience. It was a good move, allowing him to work on his batting and score runs up the order for the local club. By the end of the 1914 season, Tate had begun to establish himself in the Sussex team, even moving up to bat at the heady heights of number 8. War intervened, and Morris signed up, assigned to the 2nd / 6th Sussex Cyclist Battalion, and then to the 6-inch Howitzer's Royal Artillery as a signaller. Sent to the Western Front, Tate said of his service, in characteristic style, "I didn't see a lot of fun in the war." When he returned to Sussex in 1919, he had transformed from a live boy to a sturdy man with wide hips and heavy shoulders. He also began to impress more of his batting skills. Making 69 runs at number 8 in his first innings back, Tate found himself swiftly promoted to 4. Though he had not always remained at such lofty heights, he did produce some decent scores, ending the 1919 season with over 1,000 first-class runs at an average of a shade over 27, including a maiden century against Lancashire at Old Trafford and 4 half-centuries to add to his haul of 48 wickets. It was not a spectacular return, but Morris ended the year with every right to call himself an all-rounder. His batting would continue to improve over the next couple of years, the highlight being a score of 203 against Northamptonshire at Hove in 1921. For Tate, his breakthrough year came in 1922, and Arthur Gilligan played a large part in the leap forward. Bowling in the nets one day to his county captain, Morris let a quicker one go and must have smiled at the sight of Gilligan's stumps being uprooted. Tait returned to his usual slow off-breaks the next ball and found his delivery being returned with interest via his captain's bat. Bowler's pride kicked in and Morris tried his faster ball twice more, taking the stumps both times. Gilligan could see this was more than a fluke. He immediately advised his professional to change his style of bowling, telling him, "I have never seen anything fizz off the wicket like those fast deliveries of yours." In the next match, Tait took 8 for 32 in Kent's second innings at Tunbridge Wells. From then on, Morris was a fast bowling all-rounder. Perhaps not quite as quick as Gilligan through the air, but with an uncanny knack of seeming to get speed off the wicket. In his first season with the new approach, he took 119 wickets at 17 apiece. The next, he would break the 200 mark at an average of fewer than 14, and become, along with Gilligan, one of Wisden's bowlers of the year. In fact, with the exception of 1933, when he took 99 scalps, Morris would take over 100 first-class wickets in every domestic season from 1922 to 1935. He would do the double of 1,000 runs and 100 wickets 9 times. By the time he ended his professional playing career in 1937, Tait had taken 2,784 first-class wickets, scored over 21,000 runs, plus 39 England caps, 155 Test wickets, and an international century to his name. A truly remarkable return for a man who, like most of his contemporaries, had lost some of his best years to the war. Because of the premature end to the South African innings, Tait and Gilligan had no time to savour their impressive bowling feat, as the latter, with no hesitation, enforced the follow-on. So it was only an hour after taking guard for the first innings that Herbie Taylor, this time accompanied by Mick Comyle, prepared to face their tormentors again. This time, however, it seemed an entirely different game, and in the 35 minutes before lunch, 34 runs were added by two batsmen who appeared mostly comfortable. Given how little time had elapsed between first and second innings, it is unlikely that such an improvement in the tourists' fortunes could be pinned on a radical change in conditions. What seems a more likely explanation is a combination of the batsmen having started to adjust to the Edgbaston pitch, a bowling attack that, while not spent, had continued unchanged for over an hour, a degree of assistance by some ragged English fielding, and the raw fact that it was simply unlikely that the South Africans would perform so poorly again. Following lunch, the batsmen took up from where they had left, Taylor collecting runs on the leg side and playing attacking shots either side of Hobbs at cover point, or Comyle dug in for a more dogged approach. It was clear that the duo of Gilligan and Tait was not going to be enough on their own this time round. Fortunately for the captain, he could throw the ball to county cricket's leading wicket-taker, who, after only 11 matches and just 20 bowling innings in the 1924 season, boasted 89 first-class wickets at an astonishing average of 8.35. Cecil Parkin, Sis, was one of cricket's most watchable characters. Mercurial, colourful and plain-speaking, he was capable of entertaining crowds and infuriating administrators in equal measure. In particular, he had an unfortunate habit of running afoul of the influential Lord Hawke. Their paths first crossed when Parkin had joined Yorkshire as a professional, making his first-class debut in 1906, aged 20. It was to be his lone appearance for the county, as soon after his debut, a complaint was received from the MCC as to his credentials for qualification. It was noted that Sis had been born 20 yards to the wrong side of the border with County Durham, and as a result, his association with Yorkshire was terminated. Lost was the irony that the president of the county cricket club, the Lincolnshire-born Hawke, had himself managed to carve out a 30-year playing career with the county. Sis crossed the Pennines and found a home playing for Church in the Lancashire Leagues. There, and in occasional minor county cricket for Durham, Parkin continued to develop his bowling skills until he was invited to fill a player shortage for Lancashire. It was his second first-class appearance, taking place some 8 years after his first. A long time in coming, but Parkin immediately proved his worth, taking 7 wickets in each innings and finishing with match figures of 14 for 99. He would play a further 5 matches for his new county that year and end the season with 34 wickets at an average of under 16. Parkin's resurrected career was to be interrupted again by the outbreak of war, and he would have to wait a further 5 years to make his 8th first-class appearance, now aged 33. On his return, Sis took 7 for 86 in the match against Derbyshire and a handsome return of 14 for 123 against his old county, Yorkshire, in the next match, bowling Lancashire to handsome victories on both occasions. Such performances were enough to win Parkin an invitation to represent the players against the gentlemen at the Oval. He would represent the players in the fixture twice in 1919 and 3 times in 1920, a turn of events that would lead to further disapproval from the quarters of Lord Hawke. The Yorkshire president's problem was that during 1919 and 1920, Parkin had not been freely at Lancashire's disposal. Sis, in 1919, had accepted an offer to play for Rochdale in the Lancashire Leagues on a weekly salary, with a £100 guaranteed benefit and an under-the-table £20 signing fee. A remarkable setup for a league professional at the time. This commitment to Rochdale meant that his availability for Lancashire was limited to only 4 appearances in 1919 and 5 the following year. As such, his inclusion in the players' ranks flew in the face of the MCC resolution of January 1919 that warned against a selection of players for representative matches who were not fully available for their county side. This state of affairs rankled Hawke to such an extent that he used the soapbox of a Yorkshire County committee meeting to broadcast his strong disapproval of Parkin's selection. The Yorkshireman's feathers must have been further ruffled then, when, still tied to Rochdale, Cecil Parkin was included not only in further players' sides, but also in England Test match sides for away and home Ashes series during 1920 and 1921. It would not be until 1922 that Parkin forwent his league commitments and pledged his availability to Lancashire full-time. As a bowler, he possessed a box of tricks. Commonly listed as an off-break bowler, it was a label that hid more than it revealed, especially in the earlier part of his career. Measuring over 6 feet, Parkin would stand tall at the top of his run before beginning a curved path to the wicket. Into his delivery stride, it was anyone's guess as to what would come down. Bowling at a good fast medium pace, he could break the ball to the leg or off, his long fingers imparting great spin, deliver an accurate Yorker, and he possessed a cunning slower ball. At times it seemed Parkin was on a mission to bowl 6 different types of ball and over, a trait that led Plum Warner to complain that it was often impossible for a captain to set a field to him. He quickly became a crowd favourite, not simply for his invention and wicket-taking ability, but because of his antics in the field and at the crease. For Parkin, cricket was and should be fun, and he was not afraid to show it. One of his favourite tricks of flicking a rolling ball from foot to hand was captured by the Pathé cameras and replayed in slow motion for cinema audiences to admire. Parkin's joie de vivre was not appreciated by all observers. The Times, in the run-up to the 1924 South African series, described him as a buffoon, good for those who persist in regarding a cricket match as jollification. Even his local Manchester Guardian complained of the effect Parkin's larking had on his batting performance, asking why he did not put away his motley for a while and get to a studious cultivation of his unmistakable talent for making at least a score of runs an innings. The Observer followed in a similar vein, arguing that Parkin could be good for 15 or 20 runs if he would just regard the wicket as a wicket rather than a music hall stage. Such grumbling meant that disquiet was never far away where Parkin was concerned, and despite his obvious talent, his place in the England side was frequently a subject of criticism and debate in the press, often ending with a grudging acceptance that there was no one better for his place. Still, his wicket-taking ability, especially on sticky wickets, was not in doubt. Parkin's first full season of 1922 saw him pick up 189 wickets at an average of 17.5. bettered only by Parker of Gloucestershire, Kennedy of Hampshire, and Freeman of Kent. The following year he passed 200 first-class wickets for the first time, with an even lower average, only beaten by his future England teammate, the great Maurice Tate. Unsurprisingly, the 1924 Wisden Almanac included Parkin alongside Tate and Gilligan in its five bowlers of the year, remarking there was something fascinating in his ceaseless experiments, though adding it was a misfortune that he has never yet had the advantage of playing under a great captain. The issue of how Parkin was managed on the field was about to rear its head again. Coming on first change for Gilligan in the second South African innings at Edgbaston, however, Parkin could find none of his usual zip. The Times noted, his changes of pace were detected readily, and his faster balls did very obviously break. The Manchester Guardian was harsher in its assessment. Nobody who has not witnessed the game will understand from Parkin's analysis how utterly harmless his attack had seemed. Parkin was showing no sign of achieving any breakthrough, and his mood would not have been improved any when he dropped an easy chance from Comale, having unusually, and oddly, found himself fielding in the slips. His captain, Gilligan, clearly made up his mind that Sis was a sticky wicket bowler alone, and after a fruitless 16 overs, all bowled on that second day, he consigned county cricket's leading wicket-taker to fielding duties for the rest of the match. Unfortunately for Gilligan, he did not have much luck with his bowling changes at either end, with Percy Fender proving expensive and Roy Kilner economical but unthreatening. It was only when Gilligan turned once more to Maurice Tate that the first wicket fell. After seeing two chances missed off his bowling, the Sussex man took a fine low catch off his own bowling to dismiss the captain, Taylor, for 34. On this occasion, one did not bring two, and despite the loss of their skipper, the South African batting continued largely unaffected, with Fred Suskin joining Comale at the crease. Suskin was a former Middlesex and Cambridge University batsman with a somewhat cramped style whose use of his pads to stiffen his defence brought criticism from some quarters. He could also play some capital shots, and his abilities were fully on display at Edgbaston, taking a more attacking approach to the innings than his resilient compatriot at the other end. The second wicket partnership pushed the score past 100 before Comale's resistance was finally broken, edging Tate to the slips for a gritty 29. Joined by the powerful and attacking left-hander Dave Norse, Suskin became the first South African to raise his bat for an attractive 50, shortly before being cleaned up by a snorter of a delivery from Gilligan, the pair having added a half-century of runs. Norse soon followed his partner back to the pavilion, accounted for by Gilligan for the second time in the match, this time caught behind, and at 161 for four, England looked firmly back in charge. Though only a little more than an hour remained on the clock, England must have harboured hopes of wrapping up the match within 2 days. The two new batsmen, Bob Catterall and Jimmy Blankenberg, had other ideas and took about the attack with gusto. Both used the drive frequently and effectively, Catterall employing it with style, Blankenberg with power. With shots being played at both ends, and the England attack looking toothless beyond Gilligan and Tate, the scoreboard ticked along with over 100 being added in the last hour. It was not a faultless innings, however, especially for the Cape Townian Blankenberg, with Tate seeing two further chances being missed off his bowling. When stumps were finally drawn with the total at 274 for four, both men had posted unbeaten half-centuries, and South Africa had made its highest score in a test match in England. It had been an admirable recovery, and while talk of a shock South African victory was fanciful, at only 134 runs behind, the tourists threatened to at least make England bat again. Tuesday, 17th of June, 1924. A moderate-sized crowd, no doubt again a result of the high entrance fee, gathered for another sun-blessed Birmingham day. England may have been in an overwhelmingly dominant position and expectant of emerging with the spoils of victory before too long. But as play got underway, the story that was beginning to emerge was of the brilliance of Bob Catterall's batting. Catterall took up from where he had left off the evening before. The young South African drove strongly, his power based on exquisite balance and timing as much as his natural strength. His wrists were quick, allowing balls that were angled into his body to be turned late to square leg, and anything dropped too wide was dismissed by a hammer blow of a square cut. He faced six English bowlers in his innings, and only Tait could be said to have caused him any trouble. It was a display that drew plaudits from around the ground and across newspapers the next day. At the start of play, however, things did not look so good for Catterall or the South African team. Blankenberg was the first to take strike, facing Gilligan from the pavilion end. Gilligan's first ball was ill-directed and a wide was quickly indicated by the umpire. His next was more like it. On target, a touch of outswing, caught the edge of the bat and flew high to the right of Percy Chapman at second slip. A shorter man would have watched the nicks sail by, but Chapman, an excellent fielder standing 6 feet 3 inches tall, pulled off a remarkable one-handed catch with the ball almost past him. Blankenberg had gone for a well-made 56. Matters were not to improve for the visitors when Nummy Dean, who had been limping since he had emerged from the pavilion 9 runs earlier, was unwisely called back for a fourth run by Catterall and was promptly run out by Wood via a strong throw from Hobbs. Dean's replacement, Buster Newpen, was soon on his way, LBW to Tait for 5, and at 295 for 7, it looked like Catterall was going to run out of support before he could reach 3 figures. Relief came in the form of the doggedness of wicketkeeper Tommy Ward, and the weaknesses apparent in England's changed bowling. Ward supported Catterall ably, defending or leaving anything around or outside off, and picking up runs on the leg side. He used his feet well, even advancing on the speedy Gilligan, a tactic which prompted his English fellow keeper to showcase his impressive reactions by faultlessly standing up to the quick bowler. Gilligan, however, was tiring, and after a couple of fast half volleys had been returned with interest to the boundary, he decided it was time for a change. It was a sign of the lack of confidence he had in the abilities of his previous change bowlers, however, that when the switch was made, Parkin, Kilner and Fender were overlooked in favour of the left arm of Frank Woolley. It was not one of the captain's most successful decisions. Catterall took a liking to the new man, and after the second 6 taken from the Kent all-rounder's bowling had bounced off the pavilion roof, Woolley was relieved of duties. It took the return of Gilligan to bowling duties to finally undo the partnership, and with the score on 350, the captain snuck a ball past Ward's bat and via pads onto the stumps. With only Pegler and Parker to come, the game as a contest was up. The only question that remained was whether these last two batsmen could remain at the crease long enough for Catterall to make a deserved century. The South African was not about to wait to find out, and facing the formidable Tait, hit 3 crisp boundaries in an over that allowed him to raise his bat for an impressive ton. The Edgbaston crowd that had been cheering him on as his score neared the 100 rose as one in acclaim. It was not only a doughty and admirable feat, given the events of the first innings, but also made Catterall the first South African to have reached 3 figures in England. For his team, however, the end was nigh. Pegler had done his job supporting Catterall to his ton, and was soon out mistiming a drive straight to Hobbs. Parker emerged to immediately demonstrate that he'd been included in the side for his bowling abilities alone. His flat-batted flail at the first ball sent a warning to Catterall that time was not on his side, and the century-maker responded by hitting out at almost every ball. His luck lasted for a short while, seeing easy catches dropped by Woolley and Kilner off successive balls, before the next chance was accepted by Hobbs to end the innings and the match. Catterall out for 120. England had won by an innings and 18 runs. While England had won the match, the plaudits went to the South Africans for what was considered a brave recovery, and Catterall in particular for his splendid innings. The press was less kind to the English effort in the second innings, with the writers sharpening their pens to skewer England's fielding and the quality of the change bowling, given that, one run out aside, all South African wickets in the match had fallen to either Gilligan or Tate. As most of the England team celebrated their victory, one of their 11 appeared to be less than satisfied. Sis Parkin was reported to be furious. Having had a miserable game, left unbowled in the first innings and barely used in the second, it seemed that, not for the first time in his career, he felt undervalued and mismanaged by his captain. In his regular column for the Weekly Dispatch, Parkin let rip. On the last morning of the Test match, it was necessary for the England captain to make many bowling changes. During these changes, I was standing all the time at mid-off, wondering what on earth I had done to be overlooked. I can say that I never felt so humiliated in the whole course of my cricket career. Mr. Gilligan bowled himself. He used Tate. He called up Frank Woolley. He went on again himself. He called back Tate. He asked Roy Kilner to bowl. And all the time I was standing there, wondering how I had ever managed to get to the top of the English bowling averages this season. I admit that on Monday I was not at my best, but why should Mr. Gilligan have assumed that I would be worse than useless on Tuesday? Beside his duty to his side, a captain has a duty to his bowlers, who have their feelings. I could take the rough with the smooth with anybody, but I am not going to stand being treated as I was on Tuesday. I feel that I should not be fair to myself if I accepted an invitation to play in any further test match. Not that I expect to receive one. It was an astonishing outburst. He had, it is true, voiced criticism of a previous England captain, J.W.H.T. Douglas, following the disastrous 1921-22 tour of Australia, but not in such stinging terms, and not of his serving captain in the middle of a series. More incredible still, Parkin would later claim that not only did he not write the offending column, but had no prior knowledge of or approval of the words attributed to him. In his 1936 memoir, Parkin recalled being astonished and alarmed on discovering the content of the article published under his byline. He argued that at no time, either jocularly or otherwise, had he criticised Gilligan, and that the whole story had been invented by a journalist on the paper who he had asked to ghostwrite the column on this occasion. Sis, though, was not minded to name the offending pressman for fear of getting him into hot water. If Parkin's account is correct, and a ghostwriter had taken it on himself to effectively announce the end of a cricketer's international career without consulting him, it was a truly remarkable turn of events. Regardless of who actually wrote the controversial article, they did have a point. While he may have been ineffective with the ball on the second day, as a frontline bowler, certainly not included for his batting prowess, Parkin had every right to expect another chance as the South Africans' innings grew, and to have it before the ball had become too soft. Even Tate, who had secured what would have been Parkin's opener's berth, admitted he had reason for his grouch at not being asked to open the bowling with the skipper, though pointed to a successful partnership with Gilligan at Sussex as reason for the captain's choice of opening bowler. Gilligan's reluctance to use Parkin had been seen before during the Test match trial. The Times correspondent had complained that those people who have quite rightly a high regard for Parkin's bowling were disappointed to see that the old habit of not calling him up after several others had failed was once more in evidence. While it was widely agreed that Parkin was at his most effective with the new ball, Gilligan's decision to award that privilege to Tate and himself was understandable given their success on the second morning. However, Parkin was understandably aggrieved when he was then passed over at first, second and third change. That Gilligan had concluded that Parkin could not be trusted on dry wickets was made clear on his parting remarks that day, when he cheerfully bid his bowler farewell, saying, "I'm sorry you haven't bowled much today, sis, but I hope you will get some sticky wickets soon." Whatever the truth regarding the origin of the controversial piece, A few days later, Cecil Parkin was moved to make an apology via the Press Association. His column, he pleaded, was not meant to convey any feeling of animosity against Mr. Arthur Gilligan. Far from that, I have a great opinion of him as a sportsman and gentleman. He also wrote privately to the captain, expressing his sincere regret to you for giving you any pain. On his part, Gilligan accepted the apology gracefully and said that they remained friends despite the incident, a cordiality that extended to Gilligan agreeing to write the foreword to Parkin's autobiography. Inevitably, it was not enough to save his place in the side, and Parkin was dropped from the second test, replaced by his Lancashire teammate, Dick Tildesley. Although his fate had probably been sealed by the forthright nature of the criticism alone, it did not help Parkin's case that in April of that year, the MCC Board of Control had agreed a proposal that any player's selection for England should be conditional on their not contributing a report or a statement of any kind to the press until the end of the season as regards any test match for which he is selected. Parkin would famously clash with Hawke again in 1925 when, in the Weekly Dispatch, Sis offered his view on the captaincy of the MCC party that was touring Australia without him. Free of the hope of selection, Parkin doubled down on the earlier criticism of Gilligan and argued that Gilligan's form should see him drop from the side. If an amateur must captain the side, opined Parkin, then the MCC should appoint Percy Chapman, but he should lead the side under the supervision of Hobbs. The professional Hobbs, said Parkin, was the best captain he had played under. On hearing of Parkin's intervention, Hawke was furious. Here is a professional criticising an amateur all this distance away, thundered the chairman at Yorkshire's annual meeting. If he had been a Yorkshire professional, I do not think that Parkin would ever step on another Yorkshire cricket field. Adding as a final shot, pray God no professional will ever captain England. Words that would come to follow him around. Hawke was not alone in his outrage, however. Pelham Warner let his displeasure with Parkin be known on several occasions, including a letter to the Morning Post written in defence of Lord Hawke, that noted that the memory of Sis's criticism of Gilligan the previous summer, which, according to Warner, had offended deeply the instincts of all true cricketers, had hardly faded away when we see him again in the limelight with an effusion in equally bad taste. Parkin, he said, was a fine bowler, but his opinion on cricket matters is not on the same level of excellence, and he is not regarded by cricketers themselves as a reliable critic. Given the standing of Hawke in the MCC, and that Warner was soon to become chairman of selectors, it took no clairvoyant to see that if Parkin's international prospects had been damaged before, they were now truly dead. He never played representative cricket again, and was released from his Lancashire contract a year later. It was a sad end to the career of one of cricket's most entertaining characters, and a true talent with the ball. As for England, while it was not recognised at the time, this match was a turning point. On a rudimentary level, it was England's first home Test match victory since 1912, a fact that was of notable satisfaction in itself. However, while a victory had been secured, and the series was eventually won 3-0, this did not mean that English cricket was in rude health. The subsequent away Ashes tour would be lost 4-1. What we instead see in 1924 was the planting of the seeds which would result in an Ashes victory in 1926 and the re-establishment of England as a competitive international force. First, there was the return of the master, Hobbs, whose presence alone made any team a greater threat. Not only was the nation's cricketing talisman back, but Edgbaston had seen the establishment of perhaps England's greatest ever opening partnership, Hobbs and Sutcliffe. In 38 innings, they would go on to score 3,249 runs together, including 268 for the first wicket in the first innings of the very next match. Post 15 century stands, a number only Greenwich and Haynes have bettered, and end their partnership with a first wicket average of 87.81, a figure that continues to dwarf any other opening pairing in the history of the game. A team cannot live by bat alone, however, and while 1924 would prove to be Arthur Gilligan's international swan song, it was the start of Maurice Tate's wonderful England career. The trio of Hobbs, Sutcliffe and Tate would play 24 test matches together, winning half of them and losing only five. The road from 1914 had been a long one for English cricket, but in 1924, the patient was back on his feet. Thank you for listening to Cricket in England through five matches. Next month, we will visit Guyana for the West Indies versus England and a look at attitudes towards race and empire. Cricket in England through five matches is a production of Cricket Stuff. Find us at cricketstuff.blog or on Twitter at cricket_stuff.